Hey guys, you remember that live show we did last year?
Barely. That's when I was on Jack Daniel's pretty hard.
When did you go off Jack Daniel's exactly?
When I ran out.
Well, I do remember what you're talking about, Dave, but I remember it being really excruciating and painful, and I'm glad we're not doing that again.
Oh, well, good news, guys. We're doing it again this year.
Great, I
Oh,
look
good.
forward to it.
I've got ideas for different props this time.
So the Philly Podcast Festival invited us back again this year. And we will be doing the show live on August 20th.
And we
Excellent.
promise 100% less air horns.
That's right. We'll be live again this August 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at Amalgam Comics and Coffee House at 2578 Frankfort Avenue in Philadelphia, PA. And
Awesome.
we're going to have a guest this time, guys. Well, we had a guest last time, but this time, Ariel Johnson, the owner of and CEO of Amalgam Comics, will be there. And it's going to be a good time, I promise you.
Great.
Well, I look forward to whatever props John's bringing.
Yes.
See, I got to pack my flask, a puppy, and a copy of Mein Kampf.
And the best part to everyone out there, it's free. So if you want to see us do this foolishness live, come out and join us and support some local podcasts as part of the Philly Podcast.
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And Ben.
And John.
And this week, boys and girls, we have a very special guest with us. He was definitely a part of all of our childhoods. Well, John, Ben, and I'm not speaking for our audience.
And as well as our adulthoods, I would say.
Yes. He's worked on, his credits include such shows as Thundercats and Silverhawks, The Real Ghostbusters, The Tiny Toon Adventures.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Don't forget that one. Sorry, sorry.
I forgot that one. Thanks for bringing it up.
You're welcome.
And of course, he's also worked on such movies as The Grinch, Who Stole Christmas? That's the live action version. Cats and Dogs, Scooby Doo, The SpongeBob Movie. He's worked on The SpongeBob Show as well. And of course, he's most known for Ren and Stimpy. And of course, I can only be talking about one person, and that is Bob Camp. How are you, sir?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Little tired of the heat wave, but hanging in there.
Yeah, let's not kid ourselves. You know, based just on Ren and Stimpy alone, he's got like most people our age or even a little bit younger. But given everything else, everybody's childhood has been affected by this guy.
Yeah. Sorry, I apologize.
You know, real basically, a lot of times we like to start out this way. Was being a cartoonist something you wanted to do your whole life?
I guess so. It's kind of what I did my whole life. My earliest accounts of drawing, I think, were when I was three. My mom got me a little blue suitcase that I carried around with me when I was a little kid, and it had, you know, crayons and watercolors and paper and stuff. And I'd just sit and draw. And when other people were studying in school, I was sitting at the back of the class drawing all the time.
Cool. So I guess your mother encouraged your art?
I was the youngest of eight. She just didn't give a shit anymore.
Nice.
No, she knew that it was what I was built to do, and she encouraged it. And, you know, she understood that my, you know, C grade average wasn't because I was stupid or anything. It was just because I just wasn't interested and I had better things to do.
Yes. No, I totally understand that. I was always a musician, growing up, and, all my music classes always got straight A's, but, when it came to some of the other ones, I wasn't as interested. So, what are some of the earliest jobs you, actually got?
I think my first art type job was working at Six Flags Over Texas doing caricatures when I was 16.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
And I did also did portraits there. I picked up both pretty quickly, and for quite a while after that, I lived on the road and traveled around to fairs and rodeos and home shows and amusement parks doing portraits and caricatures. I even traveled all over Canada. For a while, I had a VW bus that I lived in with my dog, and his name was Flegel. Yes, and he was named after the character from the Banana Splits.
Oh, man. That brings me back.
Yeah. But that's it. I was, I started out as a street artist, and I, you know, went to Provincetown and New Orleans and San Antonio. Any place there were tourists who wanted their picture drawn, I went there.
Cool. So that was, when you were younger and 16, did you ever go to college and get formal training in art or?
Yeah, I went to Tarrant County Junior College in Fort Worth, mm-hmm. where I'm from. I went there for a couple of years, and then I transferred to University of Texas at Arlington, and I started out studying art there, and ended up dropping out of all my art classes because I really felt like I wasn't getting anything out of it, and I was already making a living as an artist, and I switched over to a film major, and I studied film after that.
Oh, okay. So who were some of the – you said that, you were good at doing the caricatures and obviously you, I'm not trying to make an assumption here, but it seems like you always lean towards like a cartoon style, being a cartoonist. Who were some of your early influences?
I think Mad Magazine, of course, is probably my biggest influence. All the Mad guys, Wally Wood, Mort Drucker, Jack Davis, who passed away just recently, by the way.
Yes.
Don Martin, Sergio Aragonés, all the great Mad artists. Of course, I had a lot of influence from animated cartoons, the Warner Brothers cartoons from the 40s, Hanna-Barbera cartoons from television, UPA cartoons, any kind of cartoons I could watch. And, of course, Disney to a degree. Animation in general. But I never really thought about getting into the animation business, and I sort of happened into it because a roommate of mine, when I was living in New York, after I stopped doing caricatures, I moved to New York City, and I was living in a loft with a bunch of artists in Tribeca, and one of the roommates we had there for a while was a fellow named Jim Meskimen, who he's a TV actor and comedian, and he's in movies and stuff. He's in a lot of Ron Howard's movies. But at the time, he was a cartoonist, and he was working at Rankin Bass on Thundercats. And he had made the decision that he didn't want to be a cartoonist anymore and that he wanted to be an actor and a comedian. And he said, well, my job's open if you want it. So in the meantime, I was working at Marvel in the bullpen, working on Crazy Man. I did a lot of work at Marvel Comics, by the way. I was working on Crazy Magazine, G.I. Joe, The Nom, Conan, Bizarre Adventure, Savage Tales, lots of Marvel titles. So the 80s was a busy time for me doing that. And then I shifted over, started working more and more in animation on all the Rankin Bass shows. While I was there, I worked on Thundercats, Silverhawks, Tiger Sharks, Street Frogs, Mini Monsters, Karate Cat, and was the other one. There was one other one. I don't remember. But I just jumped into animation full time doing, at that time, character designs. At some point, I got kind of fed up with doing comics. And me and a fellow named Vincent Waller, who was one of my roommates and had been a friend since we were teenagers, hopped in my 66 T-Bird and drove out to Los Angeles and started working in animation full time.
Okay. So to back up just a little bit, I didn't realize that you had worked at Marvel. So you were working on, like you said, G.I. Joe, Crazy Magazine, Conan and whatnot. So, was that doing interiors or covers or?
Yeah, I did. Well, for Crazy Magazine, I was doing movie parodies. I was sort of like the crazy Mort Drucker. And not saying I'm as good as Mort Drucker, but that was sort of the shoes I was trying to fill. And then when Crazy folded, I at the time was working for Larry Hama, the great Larry Hama, creator of G.I. Joe.
Yes.
At the time, he was an editor at Marvel. He actually gave me my first print work, because before I met him, I was just a street artist. And when Crazy folded, he started putting me on his other books, which were The Nam and G.I. Joe and a lot of Conan. For a while, I was a John Buscema's inker. I inked a lot of John Buscema, in fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Cool. And I was doing finishes over his breakdowns, so there wasn't a whole lot there. You know, there was pretty minimalistic. I think at the time his page quota for Marvel was 78 pages a month. So he was doing them, you know, quick. They were you know, if you knew what to look for, there was really solid drawing, and I was able to build on that. I learned a whole lot working over Buscema, in fact.
Cool.
Yeah. Now, I was going to make note there was a, so with the Marvel stuff and then the early television stuff, there was a big style change from that stuff to what you're more well known for, from basically from Beanie and C. Salon. Do you have a preference style wise between like the very realistic and the more, I'll say, cartoony styles?
Yeah.
Exaggerated?
I like the cartoony stuff because it's easier. It you know, drawing like John Buscema is freaking hard. it's you know, because you got to pay attention. You just can't knock something out. Plus, I do comic conventions, which is where we met. So I've gotten to where I can knock out Ren and Stimpy's pretty quick. You know, I don't have to put much thought into it. But then some, you know, occasional a-hole will walk up and ask me to draw, you know, like, you know, realistic Superman or something, and I know I'm in real trouble.
Yeah.
but
has anyone asked you
if I have to? You know,
has anyone asked you to draw a Kylo Ren and Stimpy?
Oh God.
You know what? A lot, and I like say, well, yeah, I thought of that too. You know, but the guy's got a hat on his face. You know, you can't see his head.
That's true.
So it's like, okay, I get it, Ren, Kylo Ren, but. You know, I it doesn't work out drawing it, you know. plus, as soon as the character went public, everybody started drawing Kylo Ren and Stimpy, you know. So it's okay, though. It's a cool idea. I just never got around to doing it.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, I guess you could say that, too, with the real Ghostbusters, like, that was more of a cartoony style, too. Like, you know, that was somewhere in between. I've always wondered about that show, and I don't know how involved you were with the production of the show, where I never understood when I was a kid why there was a Ghostbusters show that came out that had nothing to do with the movie, and then the real Ghostbusters came along.
Yeah, I think that are you talking about the one that had the gorilla?
Yes.
Yeah,
that yes.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Well, that was kind of coincidental, and I think it was something that kind of happened on its own, and it was already out before – they decided to make a Ghostbusters animated series to go along with the movie franchise. So they just, you know, put the real on the front of it.
It had to do with the licensing thing, actually, because there was actually a live action Ghostbusters back in the early 70s when they had Saturday morning cartoons.
And it had Larry Storch and who else was in it? The guy, it was both, was the Sarge from F Troop in it too?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And a gorilla. Right.
Yeah. So that they had the license for that for a cartoon, but then of course Ghostbusters came out the movie, which had nothing to do with that old TV series, but they couldn't call it the real Ghostbusters cartoon couldn't be called Ghostbusters because they'd already had a license for that. And they were making that at the same time as the first season of Ghostbusters, so they came out with the real Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, there were two teams on Ghostbusters. There's one that did it for season one, and then season two was a separate house, I guess a separate animation house that did it, because the animation changed quite a bit between the two.
Maybe. I don't know. I the show was in production when I started on it. I arrived out in California, and I started working. I just walked into Deke and got a job, and they put me on Alf Tales, which was an animated spinoff of the TV series Alf.
Yep.
And I was on that cartoon. I was on that for like 2 days, and I quit. I saw that they were doing this Ghostbusters thing, and I'd been a Ghostbusters fan because I used to live in New York, and while they were shooting the first movie, I was like hanging around watching them shoot it. I was already a fan, you know, so I thought, no, I want to do this. So I jumped on to Ghostbusters, and they sent me down to a young fellow named Bruce Timm, who you may have heard of. We sat there all day having a blast drawing ghosts, you know, and monsters and things like that. And I picked up a whole lot from him. He's a phenomenal artist, and he's sort of like the cartoon equivalent of Robin Williams, because there's nobody better or faster, and he could walk up and look at what you're drawing and just look at it and own it. You know, he's like a sponge. He can soak it up. And I do that to a degree too, but he's one of the fastest, most talented cartoonists I've ever seen. And I used to call him the human sewing machine, because watching his hand move was just like a blur. You know, he'd like be drawing 1,000 miles an hour and chain smoking cigarettes and just being an amazing artist. So I picked up a lot of stylistic stuff from him just sitting next to him, you know, through osmosis. I had already had a lot of experience doing character design on 5 or 6 different Rankin Bass shows, which had different styles. So I was already a pretty good shapeshifter stylistically. I remember one of the guys on the show who was what was his job? He was an art director on the show, and he came over and started giving me grief about the fact that my drawing was becoming more and more stylized and less realistic. And I just basically kind of told him to F off, you know, because I knew I was picking up some good stuff. And meanwhile, down the hall, this guy named Jim Gomez, who was one of the first people I met when I moved to L.A., was working with John Kay on The New Adventures of Beanie and Cecil,
right,
for ABC. So I said, screw it, I'm going to go work with these guys. So I ran down the hall and started working on that with a bunch of really seriously strange people, a lot of which were veterans of the Bakshi-run Mighty Mouse show.
Yeah.
And they already had been spoiled working in a situation where there were no rules and people were happier than hell to just do whatever they want, and it was a pretty wild scene. Bunch of really talented guys, but doing really crazy stuff and not really giving a shit whether the network cared about it or not, you know. That a lot of that sort of Ren and Stimpy rebellion stuff comes directly out of the Mighty Mouse show with Bakshi.
Huh. Yeah, it was definitely a very irreverent style that that shook things up a lot, and it definitely was reaching to a wider audience than I think the networks knew they were trying to reach.
Yeah, I remember one funny story. The woman who was the executive for ABC, I think her name was Jenny Triez, we had a cartoon come in from animation, and John and I and Jenny were in the screening room, and we were screening the rough cut to her. Or the animation had just come back. We hadn't even really looked at it yet. We were showing it. And you know how at the end of every Beanie and Cecil cartoon, Cecil and Beanie sing the Bob Clampy cartoon. They sing a little song, you know.
Right.
And the footage was pretty funny. It was Cecil just standing in the water, and he sings the Bob Clampy cartoon song. And then Beanie comes floating in a wooden wash tub. And Cecil leans down and snorts Beanie up into his nose, swallows, and then spits out his clothing. Beanie. And we were just sitting there watching this with Jenny Tria's sort of silhouetted in front of us. And her shoulders shot up and she screamed. And John and I ran out of the room, practically knocking each other down, and ran and hid in his office and locked the door. And when we came out, she was gone. that was kind of crazy times. And shortly thereafter, they informed us all that we were fired. Everybody went off and got drunk. And the ones who didn't go off and get drunk, get drunk, stole everything. got back. The animation discs were gone. All the art supplies were gone. The storyboards were gone. Everything. People just like loaded up everything and left.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy times. But, you know, that's kind of where I got hooked up with all the Ren and Stimpy people before Ren and Stimpy existed.
That seems like a good group of people to get hooked up with.
Yeah.
And one other thing, back to just the Ghostbusters just for a second. The story editor was Michael J. Straczynski. Did you work with him?
No, not at all.
Oh.
I remember the name, but like I would just get script pages and, you know, names of characters would be circled, and I would read the description and I'd just draw it, you know. I was in the art department. I wasn't really in the story department, you know.
So is that the way it works for most of these then? That's all you get to work off of, and you don't even know how it fits into the story? You just know what the panels are supposed to look like, or the animation is?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Sometimes it depends. You know, sometimes you start off with character designs. Sometimes you have to do the designs when you get the script. Different studios work different ways, but generally speaking, you're working off a script. And sometimes, if you've got a director that draws, they'll do sketches for you. Sit down and they'll show you what they're looking for. But I always had pretty much freedom to create whatever I wanted to. Nobody complained much about my drawing.
So, was it your relationship with Bruce Timm that brought you into Tiny Toons?
No, I got Bruce the job on Tiny Toons.
Oh,
nice.
I was one of the first people they hired on Tiny Toons, and they kind of lied to us. They said, "Oh, it's going to be just like the old Warner Brothers Termite Terrace. It's going to be run by the artists, and it's going to be storyboard driven, and all this bullshit." And it was two or three of us started on it right off the bat, and I called Bruce. I said, "Hey, Bruce, you got to come work at Warner Brothers. It's great over here." So. It's my fault. Bruce Timm's still at Warner Brothers.
that was probably
to this day.
Yeah, that was Providence. That wasn't.
Yeah, well, apparently it was the right move for him. You know, he's been there ever since.
I think he owes you a beer then.
Yeah, I haven't seen Bruce in, God, I don't know how long. I don't know, 18, 20 years. Who knows? But we sort of. Got our start together doing that stuff.
And then from, again, you were a storyboard artist there. Did you interact at all with Steven Spielberg, or was that like, you know?
Oh, that was kind of funny.
Okay.
Well, Steve, I never saw Steven, but we would have story meetings and his people would show up. And
his
people would show up, and they were women, and they were the eyes and ears of Steven. And I remember there was a story. You remember the Ren and Stimpy, the haunted house Ren and Stimpy? The one where Ren and Stimpy go to the haunted house, and there's a kind of a milquetoast little ghost there that keeps trying to scare him. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they finally kill him, and he turns into a naked black man and drives away in a Cadillac. Remember that one?
Yes.
It is sparking the memory now, yes.
How could you forget? Right? But anyway, that board was originally a board that Jim Smith and I did for Tiny Toons, and it was they had this meeting, and one of the people, one of Spielberg's people, was there, and they said, "Well, you know, Steven's son Max was his kid, who was a little kid at the time, had an idea for a cartoon, and we want you guys to make it, and the idea is that the pig and the duck." Go to a haunted house and they meet up a ghost, but it's not just any ghost. It's a friendly ghost. And it took all of my self control to not jump up. Oh, you mean like Casper? You know, right. Because somebody did that like 50 years ago, but yep. No, yep. I didn't do it. And, so they rewrote it. And we fully storyboarded it. And I remember, the storyboard we did was, I guess, shocking to them, and they completely rejected it. So when I quit Tiny Toons and we started doing Ren and Stimpy, I realized, well, we got this storyboard laying around. Let's just erase the duck and the pig and make it Ren and Stimpy. So that's what we did.
Now, nice. Was being storyboard director on Attack of the Killer Tomatoes what contributed to the psychosis you needed to do the Ren and Stimpy show?
You know, I don't think I was a storyboard director. I think I did one storyboard on that. So
really?
Your information might be wrong. I remember doing the storyboard and then thinking, why the hell am I doing this? and the reason I did it is I think it kind of came around between when we did the pilot and when we did the series. And we were all sort of there, you know, the Ren and Stimpy early crew, the first four or five of us were there. But we didn't have any work. We were waiting for Ren and Stimpy to get off the ground. So I picked up the Killer Tomato job. And I remember, like, I don't even think I showed it to anybody because I was so horrified and embarrassed by it. I'm surprised I actually remember working on it because I have, it's like kind of a rape memory or something. I've cleansed it from my brain. You know, I don't remember much about it. But I think that as far as, you know, the kind of cartoons I've made and the work I've done, it's, you know, it could be part of any kind of weird thing that happened to me in my life that encouraged it. But,
so where'd you, what got you going with Ren and Stimpy? I mean, when you're just starting out, were the characters already fully formed, or did somebody else come up with them, or how did that all work?
The characters were characters that John created with this guy named Felix Forte, I think was his last name, and Jim Gomez. They all went to Sheridan College in Canada together because, you know, they're Canadian. And they made up these characters, but they were just sort of these characters. They weren't, there wasn't anything more to them than that. It was just a dog and a cat character. And we got office space with Jerry Beck. You know Jerry Beck, the animation scholar, written lots of books about animation.
Right.
And him and Carl Masek had a company called Streamline Pictures at the time. They were trying to distribute the work of an animator named Miyazaki. You may have heard of him. But at the time, nobody had heard of him. And they were trying to get My Neighbor Totoro into American theaters. And they had even hired out actors to record American dialogue over it and everything. So John and Kay and I were sharing an office with Jerry Beck. And we didn't even have furniture. We were like sitting on the floor, drawing on our laps, and trying to pick up work. And so Carl had some connections with people at Nickelodeon, and he got John in to pitch some show ideas. One of the show ideas he pitched was called Your Gang, which was a parody of Our Gang, like the old Little Rascals show.
Mm-hmm.
And there were minor characters in it, a dog and a cat named Ren and Stimpy, and Vanessa Coffey, who pretty much single-handedly made Nicktoons happen, encouraged the development of the dog and the cat. So that's kind of where we started from. You know, we had a kind of a despicable, mean dog and a gullible, lovable cat and their relationship, and that's kind of what it's all built on. So then we did the pilot, Big House Blues, which is just a gag cartoon about going to jail. And we sort of went haywire on that and did all kinds of crazy stuff. I painted all the backgrounds on it, in fact, because I was the only one then that could paint. It ran on the Spike and Mike Animation Festival in theaters around the country. It got really good response, and a lot of people in the animation business like perked up and said, well, hey, what's this? What's going on here? So Nickelodeon picked up the show, and we started making Ren and Stimpy.
Were they really surprised? It was like one of the first memes, technically. I mean, it took over popular culture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, was it a surprise? I mean, how did you deal with that? I mean, did you have groupies?
You know, it's funny because at first we were just, you know, making the cartoon, and the fact that somebody let us make a cartoon didn't mean we actually knew how to do it. And I hadn't had much experience at all on the kind of level that I was suddenly thrust into on the show. And John, you know, as talented as he is, isn't the greatest organizer or a studio head. And our relationship from the outset was sketchy with the network because we were a bunch of crazy assholes. It's true. We really didn't really know that it was a huge hit right away, but it became apparent right away or pretty quickly that people were getting upset because we were missing deadlines. So that meant that they were paying attention, you know. Then I got a call from a guy. He's passed away since. I can't remember his name, but he ran Golden Apple Comics on Melrose in Hollywood. And he called me up and said, "Hey, you know, you guys want to come out and do a signing at my comic book store?" So I said, "Sure." So we showed up there, and there were like 3,000 people waiting in line. It was wow. literally a mile-long line of people waiting to get their autographs. And we were there all day drawing pictures and signing autographs and stuff. And we knew then that it was big. And I think when it really took off is when they started showing it on MTV. That's when it really got noticed by the college kids, the yeah. Stone crowd. That was our real audience.
Yeah, I was in college then, so I remember that.
Oh, you're the one.
I was the one. I will say, though, that was a very seminal cartoon. It changed a lot of things stylistically. That, like, there are things that are, and I know that you worked on some of these shows, so I don't know, maybe you copied them. But one of the things that I remember first seeing in that cartoon was the whole, and maybe it wasn't the first time it was done, but it's the first time I noticed it, was the whole transition between you have, you know, your traditional, you know, cartoon style, and then you have like the close-up, you know, scan of a highly detailed picture.
Yeah.
You know, with brutal detail.
brutal. I started that. I on the pilot, like I said, I painted all the backgrounds in the yeah. pilot. And at the beginning of it, there's this sort of montage sequence, you know, and it's Jim Smith's Texas accent talking about, you know, Ren and Stimpy and telling their story. And it was just one painting after another. And we sort of had the theory that if you had to do something gross, paint it and put lots of pores in it and do it right. with all the love you can muster. You know, it was it was kind of like not really porn, but sort of like had that sort of thing going on where there was just more to it than. Yeah.
Oh, it was disaster porn is what it was.
it kind of was. But it was just, you know, like pushing things and pushing things and pushing things. And that was the one yeah. thing that was always in John's mind, is to push the envelope to the point of getting us all fired again. that's what we did. And we were always pushing. And of course, you know, the network would push back but we got eventually pretty good at working with the network, especially after Games took over the show. Our relationship with the network was a lot better then, and we were actually making deadlines and getting a lot of cartoons made. But, you know, I would have to deal with broadcast standards and practices, which is, you know, any network has an in-house group whose job it is to find things that they think that the FCC might find objectionable and get it out of the cartoon before they pull their license and take them off the air, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like a self-policing entity within any network. And I used to call them double standards and practices. I'd have to be on the phone with these people. And there was this guy, really good guy named Will McRobb. He's a pretty successful writer. He wrote Pete and Pete. He wrote a lot of those live action Nicktoon shows, the shows they had on Nickelodeon, you know, in the 90s. Right. And he was the story editor. He was the poor guy who had to be the go-between between the Nickelodeon people who write notes and us. And so, you know, to his credit, he had to deal with us being kind of snarky. But it worked out okay. And what we started doing is we would put red herring jokes in the cartoons, jokes that we wanted them to take out so that they wouldn't cut plot points or anything that we really loved. And, you know, usually if something's kind of edgy, it's probably pretty funny and it's something we want to hang on to. So we would put jokes in on purpose for them to take out. But sometimes they would miss those completely and then take out other stuff for the wrong reasons. Like we got strange notes. There was a cartoon called Prehistoric Stimpy, where Ren and Stimpy go to the Museum of Science and History to get a tour to find out what happened to the dinosaurs. And the tour guide is Wilbur Cobb, who's not actually a tour guide. He's a lonely bone polisher. And he gives him a tour, you know. And one of the notes we got was, please remove the marijuana trees from the backgrounds. Those are ferns. but like speaking of Wilbur Cobb in that very cartoon, and I tell the story a lot because I still can't believe it. They said, so Wilbur Cobb's telling Ren and Stimpy why the dinosaurs died. And he says, they ran with scissors. No, they went swimming a half hour after they ate. No, I'll tell you what killed the dinosaurs. It was jock itch, really bad jock itch. Well, the network said, Oh, no, you can't say jock itch. And I said, well, why not? There's Cruex ads on TV all day. Why can't we say jock itch? And they said, no, you can't do it. And I said, well, okay, I'm going to think of something. I'll call you back. So I called back and I said, hi, it's Bob. Can we say hemorrhoids? And they said, oh, sure. And I about shit myself. I was so happy. I just said, I hung up before I would say something to screw it up or laugh too loud or something. Nice. Act too happy, you know. So I called, and of course, Jack Carter did the voice of Wilbur Cobb, the great comedian, Jack Carter, who was wonderful to work with. And I called him up and said, Jack, you better get over here quick. This may be the high point of your career. So Jack showed up, and the delivery, I'll do my, it's not, I can't do Jack Carter justice, but he said, I'll tell you what killed the dinosaurs. It was hemorrhoids. Really bad hemorrhoids. So, you know, that was one of the instances where we got away with something because, you know, the network were hung up on jock itch or something. Right. I don't know.
Well, you shift the melody a couple inches, it's all good.
Yeah. yes, and apparently a lonely bone polisher is just fine.
Yeah.
So I have a weird thought. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, well, yes, of course. This is why you keep me on. But so Ren and Stimpy came out in 1991 on Nickelodeon, and 2 years later we got Beavis and Butthead, which also pushed. Now that was on MTV, which, you know, of course could write its own ticket at the time. But do you think like your work with Ren and Stimpy and the stuff that you guys got past and started pushing the envelope there actually made it possible for like Beavis and Butthead and then, you know, all these other much weirder, much grosser cartoons to come out from then on?
Yeah, maybe. It's funny because we got a tape in the mail from Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead when we were doing Ren and Stimpy, like before anybody had ever seen it, you know?
Oh, neat.
And we watched it and we were dying laughing. It was Frog Baseball. We were cracking up and I thought, this is the greatest thing on earth, but it'll never get made. You know, we were like, no way you're getting this on TV. And then sure enough, it got picked up. And same with South Park. We got a videotape in the mail and we watched it and we're like, ha ha ha, this is the best thing ever, but no way you're going to get this made. You know? But little did we know, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, 20 years later and they're still on.
They're still on. And Ren and Stimpy's like toast.
Yeah. Powder toast?
Yeah, powder toast, exactly, right.
Toast.
Do you ever look back on some of these stories and then look at, you know, the stuff that they've gotten away with in the last 20 years, and just think, you know, either A, you're responsible for all of this, or B, you're just, you know, how are they getting, what jokes are they sneaking in to get cut?
Yeah, I don't.
Or C, I should call my lawyer because I came up with that.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because people ask me all the time if it bothers me that people rip me off. It's like, please rip me off. You know, I everything I know how to do, I picked up from somebody else. You know, I owe everything I am to Harvey Kurtzman, to Mad Magazine, to Jack Davis, to like Don Martin, to all these great cartoonists whose work I grew up looking at. And if you look at the first Ren and Stimpy we made, the pilot, all the background characters were ripped off from Milt Gross comic books. Every one of them straight ahead just copied them. You know, oh, let's use this dog. We like this dog, you know. So it was like we kind of did it because we wanted to, and nobody said we couldn't. And the people we were working for had no idea because they never had heard of Milt Gross before. They didn't read comic books growing up, you know. When I see stuff that looks like stuff we did, I'm happy. You know, it makes me feel like, you know, we're passing it along. I really don't feel bad at all about that. It's funny, though, because a couple of times it's kind of come back and bit me on the ass. So when after Ren and Stimpy, Jim Gomez and I pitched a series idea to Hanna-Barbera before it became Cartoon Network. Mm-hmm. And Fred Siebert was in there at that point, and he was making that What a Cartoon series, which the Powerpuff Girls and Dexter's Lab came out of.
Mm.
But, like, 36 of those pilots were Ren and Stimpy ripoffs, you know. They were just like, you know, cartoons just like Ren and Stimpy, only they weren't, you know. And so at the time, we were pitching the show to Hanna-Barbera, and our lawyers were talking to their lawyers, and it was looking like it was a done deal. And then I pitched the show concept to Fred Siebert, Frederator, and before he was Frederator, and he kind of laughed. He laughed a lot while we were pitching, and then he shook my hand and said, "Well, it was great that we finally got to meet," and walked out. And we're like, "Huh?" You know, so we got turned down. And I called the lady we'd been talking to after, and I said, "So he passed, right?" And she said, "Yeah, he passed." And I said, "Well, can you please tell me why?" And she said, "You're not going to like it." And I said, "I already don't like it. Why?" And she said, "It's because he said that your stuff looks like a lot of stuff we're already doing."
Oh.
And right. So, wow. And I, you know, I ran into that a lot, that I was sort of seen as a bad copy of myself. I don't know. Huh. But it's okay, though. You know, I could always find work, and I'm pretty much of a shapeshifter, so I can always work on something else, a different style. So that's what I did, you know.
Yeah. That's funny. Speaking corporate ease, it should have been like, "Wow, he's on the same he's on the same level as me, and he can hit the ground running." I mean,
yeah,
should have been like,
I don't know, but you know, and the one thing about the animation business is the suits work year round, and the artists are the first to go when the show's over. You know, they'll literally just walk in mid drawing and say, "Okay, you're done. Thanks. Goodbye." You know, and we don't have pensions, and we don't have 401ks and all that shit. We're just like ditch diggers. Here comes the ugly part of my life is I equate being a storyboard artist to being a ditch digger, because your pencil is your shovel, and right, you're down in the ditch digging, and you can only dig so many shovelfuls a day. So the only way to make more money is to work more hours in the day. So that means less sleep and exhaustion. So the only way to make more money doing storyboards is to do more storyboards and be faster. If you're somebody like me who really cares about quality, that kind of gets in the way of doing a good job. It occurred to me that the way to really make the money is to be the guy standing above the ditch yelling at the guy with the shovel saying, "Dig, dig faster," you know, because those are the people that make the money, not the art. It's rare that an artist does well in the business. Once in a while, you get guys like Seth MacFarlane, who does Family Guy. You run into guys like that who actually have sold their soul to the devil, they'll burn in eternal hell, but in the meantime they're handsome and rich and can sing like Harry Connick Jr.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
But I'm not bitter.
No.
I know Seth a little bit. He's an interesting guy. He told me a story about how he had been on one of the flights that was supposed to crash on 9/11, and he missed his flight because he got drunk at the airport. Right, so that again proves my point that he sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah.
He's got protection, you know. He's a good guy, though. You know, I'm happy for his success. Anytime one of us makes it, I'm happy, because
right,
you know, he at the beginning he was just a guy like me doing storyboards on a cartoon show. He was doing Johnny Bravo, in fact.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So So Ren and Stimpy, you know, everybody knows that, but that for you was by no means, you know, anywhere close to the last thing you did. You've done, and I'm looking at IMDb here, so of course I'll probably get some stuff. Some stuff won't be right, but Cow and Chicken, Osmosis Jones, Adventures of Bill and Grim Adventures of Bill and Mandy, which was very big. Mm-hmm. Ozzy and Drix, Jackie Chan Adventures, which I think is very underestimated as far as how good it actually was. And I think a lot more people would have watched it had they known that it wasn't strictly a kid's show. It was Symbionic Titan. I mean,
yeah.
But you were going to say?
Oh, I worked on the Jackie Chan thing. I did one board for them. And it was extremely difficult because I had to really figure out martial arts. And I had done some martial arts. I'd done a little kung fu at some point. So I had some understanding of it. But, you know, as far as the cinematography, you're suddenly doing martial arts cinematography, which is a whole different thing than doing other kinds of cartoons. I enjoyed doing it. I was proud of the end product, but it was really hard, and the pay just sucked. And I realized afterward I didn't want to do it again. And that happens a lot. You know, you work on something that's, you know, they want it quick, fast, and magnificent, you know, and I want to say pick two, you can't have all three, you know.
I can imagine something like that specifically would be very unforgiving. Like, you would have to learn, you know, martial arts is difficult on its own, but doing animation of martial arts cannot be easy, especially coming into it cold. And, you know, while it's difficult to learn, it's easy to critique, and everyone plays armchair quarterback to these things. If it doesn't, you know, no one can tell you when exactly it's right, but they can tell you what's wrong.
Yeah, but it's Jackie Chan, you know, instead of swords, you just give him a windshield wiper or something, or, you know, right? It's that easy, right?
You know what? It's funny because I see people post on Facebook talking about how difficult being an artist is. And it's always hard. It's never easy. And it's a tough lifestyle, especially if you're a freelance artist, because you're stressed out if you don't have work, and you're stressed out if you do have work. Mm-hmm. If you have work, it's late already. Often you're given terrible scripts. And if you're like me, you're absolutely incapable of doing a terrible storyboard. You'll come in late to avoid doing something that just doesn't work, you know, it's a struggle. It's always a struggle. And there's always stress. So, that's the one downside of doing that for a living. I teach, I don't know if you know this, I teach storyboard animation at the School of Visual Arts in New York City.
Oh, all right.
Because I haven't done enough stuff already, right?
Right.
So after you tell your students, you know, what you just told us, what do you tell them to keep them from committing harakiri?
No, you know what? I tell them, look, if this is something you absolutely have to do, if this is something you're driven to do, if this has been your lifelong dream to do this, then I'm your right guy. You're in the right place, and I'll show you how to do it. But if you have any doubts about it, just don't fucking bother, because it's really hard and it'll turn you into a bitter old hack. You know, I know so many story artists that are just dismal old people who are really bitter about what the storyboarding, not just the storyboarding, but the animation business has done to them and what they've become. And the fact that a lot of times you're working on projects that you don't even bother to watch because they kind of suck. And it's not particularly fun to do. And, you know, that joy you had when you first started out in the business that, wow, something I did is on TV and it's moving. Once that wears out and wears off, and you're just left with the fact that you have stressful deadlines working on stuff that isn't particularly funny or interesting. And you think, is this something I want to keep doing? Is this something I want to, you know, spend the rest of my life doing? You really don't see a lot of rich storyboard artists. There's not a whole lot of them, you know, or animators for that matter. And the fact is that the money that they're paying now isn't much different than the money they paid in the 90s. And that goes for comic books too. You know, every now and then I'll pick up a little comic book work because I used to work in comics, and the pay is virtually the same as it was back in the 80s.
Yeah. Wow. You
know? And it's not right. It's not fair, you know. Yeah. And honestly, I blame computers because I think computers have made it easy to steal art and music. And yeah. They made it really easy to take advantage of artists, you know, and to take the fruit of their labor and give them very little in return for it.
No, yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, also talking about, you know, we met at the convention, and you go around the conventions nowadays and you see people who actually steal art online, change it a little bit in Photoshop and print it out and sell it as their own.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very difficult.
There are a few of those at PhillyCon, or the Wizard World PhillyCon, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, what can you do? You know, I mean, more and more I'm seeing that the comic conventions are hip to that, and people are starting to speak out about that, which is what they should do, because it's not right, you know. You know, it's like anything. You know, I see all the time people posting ads for T-shirt companies making Ren and Stimpy T-shirts, you know, and other T-shirts from other shows and stuff. And they're really professional looking shirts, professional looking ads and all that. But there's no trademark information on them at all. And they're clearly ripping off Nickelodeon, you know.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do about it. I don't have any rights to the characters. And, you know, I'm not going to get into a spit and fight with these people because, frankly, I don't really care. But, you know, I don't want that to come back and bite me in the butt because I draw Ren and Stimpy a lot, you know. And
right.
And I kind of figure I'm entitled to, you know.
Right, right.
Because I made up Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy for fuck's sake.
Oh, no, thanks for 2 years of my life there. Yeah. Jeez.
So I think I'm okay with drawing these.
I agree.
Oh my God, that alone gives you the right.
I still love that song, especially just the spoken parts in between the lyrics.
Oh, you know what the story of that is that, well, that voice is it's John doing the Stinky Whistleteats voice.
Right, right.
And Sticky Wizzleteats is Burl Ives. And all of the lines in that song are either lines from Burl Ives movies where he plays kind of a big murderous guy with red hair and a beard, or from his children's albums he used to record and sing, where he's a big murderous redheaded guy who sings songs to kids. You know, the if you listen to the lyrics of the songs, they're kind of odd and sort of disquieting and sort of like, wow, what did he just say? You know, so that's what that's about. It's lines from like the Big Valley, and you know, where he shoots his son Chuck Connor for being a snidely wimp, and from his children's albums. So that's the story behind that.
Huh.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. no. You know, we're getting near the end here, and I want to make sure we. We plug anything that you want to talk about. I'd gotten a list before the show started, so one of the things definitely you want people to check out is your Bob Lab on Facebook.
Yeah, Bob Lab Studios.
Studios, okay.
Yep, and we have a store there, and you can buy Ren and Stimpy memorabilia, original art. You can buy prints. You can buy animation cells from the show. And we're going to start to produce other stuff there. So, and it's a really good, place to contact us. You know, if you want to talk about something or show us something or, share something that's interesting in the animation business, you know, and also, sort of be a place for animation fans and fans of the show to meet me and Michelle and, you know, and share the love.
Nice. Right. Actually, you know, I want to say a big thank you to Michelle for helping set this up.
Yeah.
You know, she's been great, with all of this.
Yeah. I'm pretty lucky to be with her. In fact, I'm like, you know, my school days, I'm pretty good at drawing. That's kind of all I'm pretty good at. And, I'm lucky to have someone like her around to make sure that stuff gets done and the details are taken care of. Cause you know, I get into my drawing focus mode and my ADHD kicks in and, you know, all eight cylinders are firing. I'm just oblivious to the world. So I'm glad she's there taking care of that.
Yes. And you're going to be at some conventions coming up. It looks like, Terrificon, in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Right.
That's at the Mohegan Sun. That's this coming weekend.
Oh.
Nice.
All right. So, yeah, because this will go up on Wednesday. So if you're at the Mohegan Sun, make sure you go and say hi to Bob. Monsters and Robots, August 27th, 28th, in Somerset, New Jersey.
Right.
Oh, close to home for us.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Dragon Con.
I love Dragon Con.
Yeah.
It's the Kiki Con. Have you ever been?
No, but I have a lot of friends who've been, and they tell me that is the party con.
It is the party con, and it starts like a week before the con and drags on for another week after, and the whole downtown becomes involved. And there's literally 10 times more cosplay than you ever see at another con. And I mean good cosplay, like professional cosplay, you know. And it's just a really fun atmosphere, and we really enjoy it. We love Dragon Con.
Well, maybe one day someone will invite me to come along.
you gotta be pushy.
Get
out your press pass and go down. Get down there.
We're working on those.
Yeah, they're helpful. You should get them.
Yes, they are.
Another thing I want to pitch out to you guys is, you ever hear of a fellow named Thad Komorowski?
No.
He's an animation historian.
Okay.
He does a lot of film preservation. He takes a lot of silent films and old films and digitally remasters them and does preservation stuff. But he's also probably the best expert on Ren and Stimpy. And he wrote a book called Sick Little Monkeys.
Nice.
And you can buy it on Amazon. I think you can download a Kindle. And it's the entire Ren and Stimpy story beginning to end, even including the adult party cartoons, which I had nothing to do with. It really tells the sort of behind the scenes stories with a lot of interviews and insights into the process and all the dirty laundry's in there. So if you're interested in Ren and Stimpy and you want to know, you know, kind of what went down with that, and I recommend you read it. It's a good read.
Nice.
All right.
I'm already looking at the Amazon page right now.
You me too.
Yeah.
And of course you're going to be at New York Comic Con, which John and I will definitely be there this year.
Oh, yeah. So. We'll be at New York. Yeah, we love New York. That's a great show. Yeah.
We'll wave. You'll be busy and won't see it, so that's okay.
you're not going to make it over to Artist Alley?
Oh, no. We'll be there. We'll wave at you, but you'll be in the zone. So
I'll be in this. Well, you can drop by and wave at me. At New York, I usually, by the end of New York Comic Con, I'm a cripple. You know, is that a cool word to say anymore? It's not PC, but I'm...
We're not PC here.
Yeah, but that's okay. But we both are just like staggering around with, you know, torn ligaments and all this kind of just like it's a tough lifestyle because the tables and the chairs at conventions are not ergonomic. They're not designed for drawing on. They're not designed for sitting at and looking up at people and talking to them all day.
They're not Herman Miller chairs.
Yeah, no, not. And because I wear trifocals, I have to look at everybody through the bottom of my glasses. So that means that I'm bending over with my head tilted way back and my chin pointed at you, looking at you through the bottom of my glasses, and kind of wears on us. So, you know, but we're tough. We'll get through it somehow. But yeah, come see us at New York.
And so, we will.
Yeah, we'll say hi and bring ibuprofen. Apparently that will be
ibuprofen. Yeah, we'll
that's what it'll say on the bottle, at least.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know,
we'll snort it. Yeah. So yeah, come see us at New York. And like I said, if you go to Bob Lab Studios on Facebook, you can find out more of what we're doing and what's going on. And you guys are going to send us a copy of the interview.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. Definitely.
Cool.
And so a question that we usually like to wrap up on. And you're definitely somebody I want to ask this question to, is how do you measure success?
Ah, that's a good one. You know, I start this next month. I start my fourth year teaching at the School of Visual Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell my kids all the time that success has nothing to do with money. It has to do with you putting in a good day's work and feeling good about the work you've done and doing something that means something to you. And that comes from your heart. That's what real success is about. And I also tell my kids that as artists, they must be honest and whatever they say with art, because it's a form of communication. You know, artists is is one of the earliest forms of communication. It predates language, you know, and they have the ability to communicate with people that people are react to on a subconscious level. They're not even aware of. And I tell them that they have the superpower and to use it for good, you know, to be honest with whatever their message is and to not be a bullshitter and to work hard, but don't chase the almighty dollar, because that's really not what this is about. And if that's what you're into, then switch over and, you know, become a CPA or something, because you know, it's you're in the wrong place. I mean, and you know, it's you can look online and see which jobs, which careers pay the most, and a graphic artist isn't one of them, you know. Yeah. So I do try to instill in the people I meet and the people I teach and that they got to try to do something good with their art, to not be a big jerk, you know, and to try to make the world a better place. And, you know, they have that ability and they should try to do something with it.
That's cool.
That's very good cool. advice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think something it's and you're definitely live by those words. Something people should definitely take from this story or from this interview and from your story is you walked away from, you know, shows you weren't happy with, you know, you said,
are you ready for this? They asked me to be a producer on Family Guy and I turned it down. I said, nah, it's like a bad Simpsons ripoff.
Wait a minute. What do you mean? Like,
see,
it wasn't my cup of tea. You know, it's not yeah. something I'm interested in. You know, I've turned down lots of jobs that would have been pretty lucrative, but it's not something I want to do, you know?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So, right. If you're true to yourself, then you're successful.
Or stupid. Perfectly willing to admit I am, you know, whatever.
Cool. So this has actually been a lot of fun.
Thanks.
I'm glad you came on. Yeah. I you know, can't wait for our listeners to hear this. And as always, boys and girls, as we wrap up each and every show, as we always say, don't let your cape be caught in the door. Have a good week.